You're listening to the GNU World Order, Season 11, Episode 10. Hi everyone, this is Klaatu, and you are listening to episode 10 of season 11 of the GNU World Order. In this episode, I have three topics that I'm going to cover. One, art on Linux. Can it be done? The other one is blockchain. What is it? How does it work? And finally, Python IDEs. Let's get started. Been getting this a lot lately, and it's started to annoy me. It's been something that's kind of gotten on my nerves anyway, but I've kept silent about it for a long time, and for some reason it keeps cropping up again lately. So I'm going to just kind of say something that I've observed just recently to a problem that I guess I've experienced several times in the past. And the problem really are the users, isn't it always, out there who seem to think that Linux just cannot be used for creative work, which I realize it's not an argument anymore, right? We've got enough people doing creative stuff on Linux that it shouldn't really bother me. But when you get told this as a justification for just purchases or things that just make no sense, it starts to bug you, or it bugs me anyway. And I find it especially puzzling when someone who says that they're a graphics designer or a UX designer or any of those titles that sort of combine a little bit of tech with a little bit of art, or even just art, says that they have to use macOS. Why? Because it's so well designed. And I've always been suspicious of that. Like I say, I've gotten that before. Because it just doesn't seem like that sort of thing ought to matter. The opposite statement, if you think about it, would be, if I'm not using macOS, then I can't do my design work. And that's kind of something that really no craftsman should ever say about their own capabilities. It's sort of an admission of the inability to do the thing that you've claimed to be able to do. And it's especially aggravating, I guess, when the people making this statement are otherwise very boisterous and loud about how really Mac is the only way to do creative work, because there were computers, there was creative work before there were computers, so that it obviously cannot be true, but for some reason they say it with such conviction that there's almost just, you know, if you even dare question it, it's just kind of silly. It's like you're the fanatic, you know? It's like, come on, nobody questions this. I mean, surely your skills ought to transcend the surface appearance of your workbench, right? So aside from that statement, it puzzles me, because of all the things that macOS may do well, and there's an argument somewhere, I'm sure, that it does something well. I'm not clear on what it is, but I'm sure there is. Allowing the user to customize their workspace is really not one of them. The Mac OS user experience is infamously rigid. You are to use Mac OS in exactly one way, with maybe two or three different options for specific tasks. You know, you've got a menu option, and you've got maybe a keyboard shortcut for that same menu option, but that's basically it. That's what you've got. Maybe you've got a button and a toolbar, you know, sort of the three standard paths to the same end product. But if you and if you venture into unsupported third party products, you can sometimes find a couple of hacks here and there that let you do, you know, customize a little bit more. But I mean, natively, and I'm speaking as someone who As one of my gateway drugs into Linux, I explored very arduously my options for customizing the desktop, you know, that I used to use before I used Linux, which was the Mac Finder. And so I feel like I've been down that path. You know, I feel very familiar with that. I mean, I used to run Enlightenment over the Finder, you know, because and heck, I was working at Apple running the KDE desktop instead of the Finder. So I feel qualified to say that natively, without becoming a Unix guru, natively you can change, you know, maybe like seven or eight things really. You can change the background wallpaper. That's usually the first thing that people figure out. You can change some highlight features, you know, like thematic things, like the colors of selections, maybe the font used for different window labels and buttons, the color and transparency of the menu bar, and that's a new thing, and the position of your dock, at least insofar as it can be on the left or the right or the bottom. And those are your options when you sit down to on a Mac machine and you think, okay, now I want to customize the way I interact with my computer. That's it. Those are your options. And at first glance, maybe that doesn't look so bad. Maybe you think, well, that's pretty good. You know, I can change the color of this of when I click on something. I can change the highlight color, and then I can position the dock on the left. So yeah, it's pretty cool. I mean, it's like I'm doing design work here. But compare it to something, the things that you can change on a typical Linux desktop, possibly, you know, with Fluxbox or KDE. You can change what fonts, and this is, I can't even name them all, but fonts, icon theme, window borders, appearance of scroll bars, existing keyboard shortcuts. You can make your own keyboard shortcuts, launchers, docks, and I'm not talking about the placement of the dock. I'm talking about the actual dock itself. Like, do you want to use Plank? Do you want to use AWN? Do you want to use something else? You can change the dock itself. Panels, you can change where the panels are and what's in the panels, the system tray that you use, or if you use a system tray, the panel that you use, or if you use a panel. I said launchers already, contextual menus, placement of window buttons on the left or the right, and which buttons are there. You could have the close, or you could have the expand, minimize, or maximize. You can have other ones. Background color of the window panels, so it's not just the background panels, you know, not just the background color of the window. I mean, you can do it per panel in some instances. Shadows, of course, glows, window stacking, tiling, tabbing, and I didn't even mention the wallpaper yet. So, yeah, there's a lot that you can change on Linux. The difference is this: changes to the macOS user experience, and I'm sort of doing that in air quotes because it's, you know, changes to the macOS user experience doesn't really exist, but let's say it does. And if we say it does, we have to say that it's a modest kind of on-the-surface change only. You might be able to affect the experience of a user, but only within the constraints provided. Now, on a Linux desktop, you can change everything. You can change the UI appearance and the UX itself so drastically, if you wanted to, that a user literally wouldn't even know how to use your computer if they sat down in front of it. I can say this with absolute certainty because I've been there. I don't mean I've been the person who someone has sat down at my computer and not known how to use it. I tend to keep fairly guest-friendly desktop environments around. There are some idiosyncrasies, and the Dvorak keyboard certainly doesn't help. But you know, and certainly it depends on what computer. Like if you sit down at my Fluxbox computer, then yeah, an average user may not know that you're supposed to hit Super D to get a Dolphin window, and that Super D actually is Super H because on a Dvorak the D is where your H is on QWERTY. But generally speaking, I keep it pretty guest friendly, but I have sat down at my friend's computer, the last known god. I've sat down at his computer, and he was running awesome, and it was just the background. There were no panels, there was nothing. So I was like, okay, well, Fluxbox knowledge here, so I'll just hit the right button, the right mouse button. Nothing happened. I literally did not know what to do. So yes, you can change it that drastically. So which of those two sandboxes should someone with an interest in UX prefer? Surely not the one that offers no real customization. I mean, if you were a fashion designer and you'd been hired to do a big job, and so you went to the place and You sit down at your design desk and you think, okay, now I'm going to design this dress that they've hired me to design, and then someone comes in with a dress already designed and says, okay, here's the dress. We just needed you to tell us whether it should be red or blue. I mean, you wouldn't be happy with that. That would not be a job that you would continue to have, right? I mean, you just wouldn't. That wouldn't be really flexing your specialty. That, as a fashion designer, you would not consider that really worthy of your time or effort. And you would think that the same thing would go for a designer. I mean, if you were a self-respecting, quote unquote, UX designer, then surely you would sit down at a computer and think, okay, well now I'm going to place all of the things that I need exactly where I want them so that I can get my work done quicker and better. Or maybe, as is often the argument, and this is kind of the argument, the real argument that bugs me the most, I think, is that the argument somehow is as if though, well, this computer's interface is well designed, and so that will somehow bleed over into my work. It will make me a better designer because the computer interface looks pretty. That's almost verbatim what I've heard from certain people. It's kind of like, oh yeah, this will really help me because it just looks nice. It's like that's not how things work in the real world. Just because the UI looks nice, it's not going to make you a better designer. And besides that, wouldn't it be a better exercise of your skill and talent to make it look good for yourself? Like, wouldn't that be something that would speak to your designing skills, and you might even be able to learn a couple of things here and there because you're trying different things out and you're realizing, wow, that UX design choice, as great as I thought it was at the time, actually is horrible. And I would never want to impose that on anyone in any system at all. And I think there's a huge argument for this. Huge argument, because with the blank check that we typically that we so typically give to Apple and Mac. We kind of give them this thing, and it's like the certificate of accomplishment or of achievement, and it's this blank paper that we give them every single time they do anything, and it's just like, oh, that was brilliant. And I know there are some people who write about things that aren't brilliant, but I mean, the populace, I would say, basically just says, well, if Apple did it, it must be a good choice. And that's dangerous because it's really not. And if you've been listening to my show for very long, or for very long, I mean, like more than just a season or two, you'll know that I used to be an ardent, die-hard defender of the global menu bar. I thought the global menu bar, and I was very vocal about this, I thought that that was the way that God had intended computers to be designed, like a global menu bar. It just made sense. I mean, you look up at your screen and there's your menu every single time. And now I've come to realize, and it took me years to realize this, because I was so dead set that the global menu bar was the correct way to do it. And now I've realized that actually that's a horrible idea. And I honestly think that what I think that the thing that finally convinced me of that was that I had been using Linux for 5, 6 years, and then I had to do some maintenance on a computer in a print shop that it was a big freaking 30-inch print, not 30-inch, like honestly about 5 feet. It was a large format printer. I mean, it was huge. Like I could lay down in front of it, and it would still stretch past me. So it was definitely at least 5 foot paper span. And so the computer attached to it naturally had a very large monitor. And I was doing this maintenance on it or something, and sitting in front of this monitor that was huge, like it was just enormous, biggest monitor I'd ever sat in front of, and I found myself, I would be doing something in one window, and I'd need to do something in a menu. And oh my gosh, you have no idea how far away the global menu bar is until you're sitting at a 30, 40-inch monitor, and your mouse has to travel all the way up there to the upper left, and then you click File and then Save or whatever. Well, I mean, it wouldn't be that because you would just hit Control S or Command S, but I mean, you know, all the way up to the left to get to your stupid global menu bar, and it's and all you wanted to do was, you know, launch some sub window. And that, I think, if I recall correctly, that kind of made me realize, I see the flaw in this plan. Finally. I finally see why this is not a good idea. And it took me years to come to that, to come to peace with that idea. And a large part of it was because I had been brought up on Mac, and that was just always the way it had been. And when I came to Linux, it was very sort of Windows-y to me. It was very representative of Microsoft, and so therefore it must be evil that they had the menu bars in each window. And I thought, well, that's just not efficient. You know, you've got the same menu selections, or basically the same menu selections. And anyway, you're never going to need to go to a menu unless the window is highlighted anyway. So contextually, the the menu bar should, you know, and it's just, there's really, the more I thought about it, the more I realized that my argument held zero water. And so, if you're a designer and you honestly believe that your craft is to think about how things are laid out, like that's part of your thing, then I can't see how settling for the prepackaged layout would ever benefit you in any way, either skill-wise or even just kind of philosophically. You know, I can't see how that would be beneficial. Because, like, what if you just thought for a moment, what if we put the menu bars over here on the right or on the left of every window? You know, like, whatever. Like, you could just really start experimenting around with different ideas. And maybe you couldn't do it with a menu bar. Maybe that's a bit much. But maybe you could, because Qt, of course, you have a lot of control over where things appear. So, yeah, it really kind of depends. I don't see how being a serious designer matches with, well, macOS looks pretty, therefore that's the one I have to use. I mean, in fact, I would even go so far as to say that it's diametrically opposed. You know, those two concepts just, they are in conflict. I am a UX designer, therefore I need a platform that will bend to my will. That makes sense. I'm a designer, so I need something that's already been done for me. Doesn't really make a whole lot of sense. And I can hear the counter argument already. I can hear it. I don't want to design the tool. I just want to use whatever tool is comfortable for me so that I can then design the stuff that I do design. And I mean, certainly for someone who doesn't do UX design, like web designers and anybody who's not doing who doesn't have to worry about layout of interactive material, I could sort of see that as an argument. Although I would still say that the principles of design should still be flexed. You know, I mean, there should still be some flexibility in your environment. And if you can't change your environment, as a designer, I think you should find that reprehensible and constrictive. And even if not, it's a valid point. You know, maybe you don't want to design your tools. But if you're saying that, you are admitting that your skill set is limited. And that's usually, at least in my experience, counter to how this imaginary sort of conglomeration of everyone who's ever said that to me, it's counter to how that conglomerate sort of presents itself. You know, they don't say, well, so if you're saying that, right, you're saying that your art is kind of reliant on someone else's platform. I mean, you're not kind of, you are. You're saying the efficacy of your artwork, of your ability to create art, depends on the platform upon which you are working. So you're basically an extension of that tool set, right? I mean, you're the final stage in someone else's assembly line. So you're okay with that, and you should go ahead and admit it openly rather than boast about how professional and serious an artist you are and that you can't possibly consider using something else because that's just not done. You know, you should just let people know that you're a designer or graphic artist or whatever you are as part of a kind of pay-to-play Apple or Adobe or Autodesk, whatever, bubble. Like you're a member of those things. I mean, you're not hired by those companies, but you pay to to use their tools, and that is, and is that, and that is part of your art. You are working on top of these platforms. And certainly don't tell other artists that for them to be taken seriously, they can't possibly use Linux or GIMP or Inkscape or Kdenlive Live or any of those free tools, because those aren't real. Because those users, the ones that are using Linux and GIMP and Kdenlive Live and Inkscape and Scribus and all those other things, they're the ones not serving as plugins for the companies that other artists pay rent to. They're using tools that are extensions of their creative minds, not the other way around. And that's important. And I know that this whole thing has been a kind of a theoretical and mental argument, I guess, against something that at the end of the day is essentially, you know, it's an emotional argument, right? I mean, it is what it is. It's just, if someone wants to use a different platform, then that's what they're going to use, and that's how it is, and it's really not that big of a deal. But I wanted to express this because I do believe that very frequently when people get criticized for not using the right thing, like macOS, especially in the art world, it does come across, and, you know, you could argue that it's not meant that way, but I wouldn't believe you. It comes across very frequently that the implication is that well, they're not real artists then, when, again, the opposite is true. Blockchains. Man, they're all the rage now, aren't they? You hear about them all over the place. Well, at least I do. So if you probably know what a blockchain is, or at least you've heard it in context of a Bitcoin, and that's kind of why blockchain exists now, is because Bitcoin exists, and Bitcoin, since it's a currency, it needed a way to track and verify a series of events or transactions, because Bitcoin obviously doesn't have a centralized mint, but you could mine a Bitcoin, and then if you find a valid Bitcoin, you would want to add it to the pool of Bitcoins. That's fine, but you don't want someone to just invent a Bitcoin, sort of imagine a Bitcoin, and start using it in real life, you know, sending it to people to try to do transactions, because then you've got sort of a counterfeit Bitcoin, and that's not good. You don't want that to happen. That destroys the economy. So they needed a way to verify the existence and then the continued lifespan of Bitcoin, or parts of a Bitcoin. And the way that they came up with for that was a blockchain. And the blockchain, conceptually, like at its really, really most basic, is pretty surprisingly simple, I think. And I kind of, this dawned on me because a friend of mine out in the real world had asked me about blockchains, and I really was curious as to, first of all, how he knew about it and why he was asking. And he's a database programmer, or used to be a database programmer. Now he's a data analyst, I guess. And he's in the real estate business, so I didn't really think that there was any reason for him to be following that sort of thing. But I mean, maybe he's just interested in that sort of thing. So I asked, and he said that apparently the real estate industry, at least some portion of it, is really looking at blockchain as a way for their, I guess you would call it a paper trail, except without the paper. But you know, they for whatever reason they're thinking about using, about leveraging a blockchain for transactional data. And I don't know why. I don't know if it's, I don't think it's just as simple as this house was purchased and then it was purchased again and then it was sold and then it was, you know, whatever. I don't think it's just for housing stuff. I think there's there's something else in there going on, and I don't know what it is because he didn't say, and I don't know enough or care enough about real estate to have asked. The point is, though, that blockchain, I guess, is kind of making a splash in industries that I would not have necessarily expected it to even make an impact at all. And when I was explaining to him what a blockchain was and kind of how it worked at its most basic level, he kind of got it pretty quickly. And I he's a database guy, so maybe he just got it quickly because he's a smart guy. But I was pleasantly surprised. And I think it is a surprisingly simple concept, and it really, really makes sense. It's one of those simple concepts where you hear it and you just kind of think, oh, wow, that's beautiful. That's a beautiful solution that I can't believe no one thought of until 2008. So here's what we'll do. As by way of a demonstration, I invite you to follow along, but you can just listen as well. I'm going to make a directory called blockchain. And this, again, is just a demonstration. This is not how blockchains work, but it's the foundation upon which they sit. This is super, super simplified. So what we'll do is we'll echo foo, and we'll pipe that to SHA-256-SUM. I don't know if 256-SUM, SHA-256-SUM is a alias for SHA-SUM-A256 or what, but that's what I'm using because it's on my system. So if I do that out into the terminal, I get a pretty long SHA-SUM, B5BB, ending in 944C, and then a dash, because the dash means that, in this case, well, it usually means on the terminal, that it read from the standard input, which is what it did. So that's great. So we're going to redirect that, rather, into a file called foo. So echo foo pipe SHA-256-SUM. Redirect foo. So now if I cat foo, I should see exactly, yeah, I do. Okay, so that's our initial transaction, but it's not complete yet. What we want to do is we want to put an actual transaction. So what we've just recorded there is the fact that essentially there is no transaction previous to this. The SHA-SUM of this foo of the previous file is really nothing, or you could say it's the name of the current transaction. The important thing to know is that it's basically garbage. I mean, I could have echoed zero, you know, a string of zeros into foo. So don't let me fool you with that. I just put some data into a file called foo. But now presumably we want some kind of transaction to occur. So we'll do an echo of, I don't know, one Bitcoin, let's say. And we'll echo, or we'll redirect that into foo again. So now if I cat foo, I've got that string, which is just foo's name and a dash, or the string foo, the SHA-256 sum of foo, the string's foo, and then a dash. And then I've got the phrase, one Bitcoin. And that's it. That's what foo contains. So we'll say that that's a transaction. And that's the only time that we'll do a transaction exactly in that way. From this point forward, we'll do every transaction in exactly this way. We will build off of this original one. So we will say, we'll do a SHA-256 sum of the file foo. So this is the actual file containing exactly that data. And we will dump that. We will redirect that into bar. So now we have two files. So we have two transactions. One is foo. And from looking at foo, we can see that that's the first transaction because it has a SHA-SUM that resolves to its own name, followed by a dash. And we have one Bitcoin. And then if we look at bar, as our first line, we have the SHA-SUM of the actual file foo. So that starts with 4E72 and ends in DA748, followed by the word foo. So that points to the file, the transaction unique identifier, which in this case is its name, and the SHA-SUM that file should resolve to. And then what we'll do is we will echo the string, let's say 0.5 Bitcoin. And we're going to pipe that through SHA-256 sum. And we're going to redirect that again, redirect into bar. And then we are going to actually echo the string itself, 0.5 Bitcoin, redirect into bar. So now if we cat bar, we have three lines of informations. We have that first one, which points to foo with the SHA sum and the file name foo. And then we have the second string, which is the SHA sum of the contents, just the data content of this transaction, which is 0.5 Bitcoin. And again, that's followed by a dash because we calculated that SHA sum through the command line, through the standard input. And then we've got the actual string that SHA sum sort of decodes to, which is 0.5 space Bitcoin. Okay, so one more time, we will now we'll do that same process. So we'll echo another 0.5 Bitcoin because that's all we've got. No, wait. We'll first we'll grab the SHA-256 sum of bar, and we'll echo that. We'll redirect that into baz. And then we'll echo 0.5 Bitcoin again into SHA-256 sum and redirect that to baz. And then we'll echo the actual string 0.5 Bitcoin into baz. Okay, so we've got three files. And if you really think about it, if you think about what we just did, we've been building on each other, each file, we've built upon it such that essentially no file after that first initial transaction could possibly exist without the previous file being unaltered. So if I went into foo, for instance, I just Emacs foo and change one Bitcoin to two Bitcoin because I'm trying to be clever. Now, if I do a SHA-256 sum of foo, I have AE74. That's the starting point of my SHA-256 sum. Now, obviously, that will clash with the first line of my bar file because if I cat bar, the first line that it says foo should resolve to is 4E7216 blah blah blah. So it's a completely different SHA sum. So that right there would send up a bunch of red flags because it means that the file called foo in this blockchain, in this series of transactions, if I get a SHA-256 sum of it, I should get exactly 4E7216. And I just got a SHA sum of foo, and it's resolving to AE74CF95, whatever. So now, if I go back into foo and correct that, maybe it was a legitimate error. And now, if I do a SHA-256 sum of foo, sure enough, I get 4E7216CE, CFE, sorry, 2252, etc., etc. So the integrity of the file of any transaction depends on the integrity of its own contents because it has a verification SHA sum within the record, and it depends on the integrity of the file previous to it. And that's a blockchain. And as far as I know, it really is done with SHA sums. I could be wrong. But that's my understanding of it. I haven't really looked a whole lot into blockchaining, to be honest, but that's how it works. I mean, and obviously with real life blockchain, it's going to be a lot more complex than that in terms of what your data's contain and that sort of thing, but essentially that's what a blockchain is. So, hopefully that helps. People who don't know what a SHA sum is, probably that explanation wouldn't really do a whole lot for them, but I imagine you could probably gloss over that and just kind of say, look, take it on faith that computers can look at a file and generate some kind of representation of that file mathematically. It's just, it's how they store passwords, it's how they do this, it's how they do that. So just even if you've never looked at a SHA at a just if you've never used SHA-SOM, if you've never verified like a download with an MD5 sum or something like that, don't worry about it. Just take it on faith that computers can do that. And once they, if they can get past that hurdle, which most people can, then the rest of the explanation is, yeah, pretty much that. We record the data in the file, we record the previous file, and then we record the file. And that's it. Keeps going like that. And if anything changes previous, then suddenly everything gets knocked out of whack. And that, of course, goes for as far back as you want. Like if you do if you make a change, certainly in the first series, the first transaction, then you would have to go and fudge the second one and the third one and the fourth one and the fifth one and so on. So it the more transactions there are, the harder it becomes to counterfeit previous transactions. And obviously Bitcoin has extra sort of added robustness because it's distributed. It's a distributed blockchain, and there can be they can compare records to one another and make sure that all the blockchains are calculating correctly. And that's pretty cool. So that's what a blockchain is. Hopefully that helps. In episode 8, I had mentioned that I had discovered the Python idle interface had a GUI to it, and that was very surprising to me. And Doug, who you may know from this show if you've listened for a long time, or you might know him from the sort of the Python season that I had for this show, or you may not know him at all. It's okay. He's just some random guy, really, who started bugging me about learning Python and is pretty much the reason I learned Python, which is actually quite convenient for me because I ended up getting, I mean, that was a major upskill for me. I started getting jobs sort of predicated on knowing Python, really. So that was quite nice. I probably owe him like a cup of coffee at least. But he emailed me recently in response to episode 8 because I guess because I mentioned the word Python. I don't know if he has some kind of alert set up or what. I don't know how he knows, but he, well, maybe he listens to the show. I don't know. But he did email me, and he kind of started talking to me about IDEs. And he mentioned a couple, and I'd heard of them and kind of thought, well, yeah, I know them, but I'm not really that interested in them. So I pretty much ignored his email, at least his recommendations in the email. But it got me started thinking about IDEs. And I kind of looked at the range of IDEs out there. And this was good, because there are lots of great open source IDEs out there for Python, none of which I have actually used. Well, that's not true. I've used several of them. I should say none of which I'm actually a devoted user of. So I'm going to talk about them anyway. And really briefly, just because I kind of want to, I'm more than anything, if you start playing around with Python, yeah, maybe you start in a terminal running the embedded, or not the embedded, but like the in-terminal idle, not the GUI one. Maybe you start out with the GUI idle. Either way, maybe you're thinking, well, if you're doing the GUI one, I think there's some modest amount of like typing code completion in there. Although, actually, at the moment, I'm blanking on whether that's actually true. But let's assume that there is. But there are other annoying things about it, like the absence of line numbers, although I think you can turn that on, or maybe not, but either way, it's not the best in the world. And I think that's what Doug was getting at, with that idle wasn't necessarily, like, in terms of IDE, an integrated development environment, maybe idle's not exactly the pinnacle, to which I would agree. So if you're starting to do more Python, then maybe just the odd script every now and again, you might want to look at an IDE. And I'm going to just kind of rapid fire talk about the ones that I know about, but we'll put a pin in this conversation because if I'm thinking about sort of giving one or two a go myself. And so I may switch over to an IDE for a while as I develop some stuff, as I work on some stuff, and just kind of see how it treats me. Because I do know from the couple of little C++ applications that I've written here and there, which I tend to do in Qt Creator, just because why not? I do like how like Qt Creator knows exactly like if you're typing a function name or something, it knows exactly where in all of the different files that you've got in that project, it knows from where that function comes. And so that's kind of handy. And so an IDE, sort of having an awareness of the bigger project is quite nice. An IDE having an awareness of individual concepts that like not just that a variable name is a specific thing, but that specific thing is a variable, rather than, oh, that's just some or a keyword versus a variable. So that's or a function name, like the it knows that these things are different. And that is quite nice. And it's something that at least an Emacs IDE environment, as you might call it, does not typically know. I mean, you can add like autocompletes and things like that, but actually getting it to like parse everything about what you're doing. I'm sure that you can do that in Emacs, and I've seen some packages out there where they're just like, hey, you can, install these 10 elisp packages, and you'll transform Emacs into a Python IDE. And I've tried one of those. I've tried one of those at my old job, where I was doing so much Python, I was like, well, maybe I'll try one of these crazy like Emacs is my IDE things. And it seemed okay, but it never really clicked with me. I just never. I don't know whether it made Emacs feel too foreign to me, or if it just didn't do a good enough job of approximating what I thought of as an IDE, which basically is just Qt Creator. Like, that's my only real experience with an IDE is pretty much Qt Creator, so not really sure what the problem was, but it never really clicked for me. So I'll talk about the ones that I've kind of touched on in the past couple of years, but with the major caveat that basically I just do everything in Emacs, but that I am interested in exploring IDEs. So one was Stanny's Python editor. That's dead. It's still on SourceForge, but it's basically dead. I think it's dead since like 2012 or 2014. I think SourceForge has the erroneous date of 2016 as its last update, but this is, I think, SourceForge being the new SourceForge, just kind of like telling you lies for no good reason. There's Eric for idle, Eric, and it's currently on version 6, so you might call it Eric 6, and that's in very active development. Its latest release was, I think, July 2 or so of this year, like, 2 weeks ago at the time of this recording. So I've used that, and I remember liking it. And that's definitely a contender for what I will eventually settle on. We'll see. Yeah, that was a good one. There's of course PyDev, which is for Eclipse, and I actually used that a little tiny bit at an old job, where I was kind of doing some Python, and everyone in the office was using Eclipse. So I thought, well, just for solidarity, I'll use Eclipse, and I'll just install all these PyDev modules, and then we'll be good to go. And it is a project all its own, really. It really is. It feels very much like like one of those projects like where they kind of abuse some, like what's that one? I think there's literally, or there was at one time, a desktop publishing plugin for Blender where people were doing page layout in Blender. I kid you not. I think I actually read about that one in Jason Van Gumster's book, Blender for Dummies, I think. I think that's where I found out about that. But anyway, it's a publishing, desktop publishing thing for Blender. And so it feels kind of like that PyDev for Eclipse, because I mean, I think at this point they're just like, hey, just go install this special version of Eclipse. It's so different at this point. I could be making that up, but either way, it is a big install. You have to do a lot of work to get there, if it's anything like it was when I was using it. But it exists, and that's what I wanted to mention. The other one that I wanted to mention, though, and this is a newer one that I've not really used a whole lot, is Ninja, and ninja-ide.org, and it's cross-platform, just like Eric, and Eclipse for that matter, and Python itself. It's written in PyQt, or it uses the Qt framework. I don't know what they're using. I don't think it's PySide. I think it is properly. Yeah, it is. It's PyQt. So it's written in with the Qt framework. So that's kind of cool. Yeah, I should say with the Qt framework, not PyQt specifically. I don't know what it's written in. I didn't look. But it's using Qt, and that's kind of cool because I prefer Qt, even though I use WXPython sometimes as well for reasons. But Qt I prefer, so kind of writing in what I am writing out is kind of refreshing. And Ninja strikes me as a little bit minimal in feel, at least initially. And I haven't used it a whole lot, but it's pretty slick looking. It's pretty nice. You can import projects from just a source code directory, so you can kind of create projects out of things that didn't start as Ninja IDE projects, which is nice. And it has a lot of linting capabilities. I mean, when I opened up some of my code, it was underlining everything, and it had rollovers on everything. It was just all over the place. And at first it almost sort of scared me. It looked so busy and horrific. And I thought, well, you know what? This is exactly why I should start using an IDE, I said to myself, because if my code generates that much noise, then that means it could be cleaner. It could be better. It could be optimized for just formatting, really. And I think that's possibly, in addition to, like I said before, like sort of type awareness and kind of the complete whole picture of what your project actually contains. In addition to all that, just that kind of that sort of thing looking over your shoulder saying, you know what, that line's getting pretty long. Surely you could break that down a little bit, you know, and it kind of enforces all of these principles in you that maybe if you're still learning Python, maybe it would be a little bit too much because you're still just trying to figure out how to put, you know, os.path.join together and joining paths and stuff like that in a platform agnostic way, and having something then warn you, hey, you should be making that into its own variable and then calling that, you know, referring to that variable here so you got shorter lines or whatever you want to do. Maybe that's too much. But if you've been writing Python long enough to know better, I think having that sort of watchful eye kind of point out what you shouldn't be doing, maybe not because it's not going to break anything. It's just because, you know, that's too much. Cut it down, simplify, whatever. So that was really kind of enlightening, just to kind of see code that I knew was completely, you know, ran fine, worked fine, nothing wrong with it, but seeing the little things that just maybe didn't follow a certain expectation of experienced Python coders, kind of the Python style. And I think that's worth realizing, is that a lot of these programming languages, or probably all of these programming languages, they've got a little bit of a culture to them, where there are certain expectations, and people kind of want to see certain things, not necessarily because, oh, if you don't do it that way, then we won't let you into our club or anything like that. It's just more like, you should do it that way because that's what we're all used to seeing. It makes it easier to read, whatever. And certainly, if you want people to be able to collaborate and contribute, sort of following the standards, even if they're just kind of strongly encouraged standards, yeah, that's probably not a bad idea. So that's those are IDEs. The ones that I mentioned again with any amount of like sort of seriousness is Eric 6 and Ninja-IDE. Those are two quite good ones that you should maybe check out if you're interested in exploring IDEs. And certainly if you have any other IDEs that you have tried and enjoy, yeah, let me know. I'd be curious to hear about them. I mean, I know that a couple of other IDEs do, you know, do kind of permit you to do Python within them as well. So that's sometimes an option probably as well. I mean, I think last time I checked, Qt Creator could kind of handle Python projects as well. Like just raw Python, you not even necessarily. I could be wrong about that actually. The latest version might really kind of try to impose things on you, but yeah, generally speaking, you know, a lot of IDEs have modules and plugins for different things, as long as there's a reason for that language to be incorporated into the IDE. I mean, you know, obviously if it's like Qt Creator, it's not going to have hooks for something that can't, you know, that doesn't have an API for the Qt framework. It's just wouldn't make any sense, or bindings for the Qt framework. But yeah, it's good. IDEs. Thanks for the recommendation, Doug, and maybe I'll take a look at some myself. Okay, I think that's it for this episode. Thank you very much for listening, as always. My name is Klaatu. You can find me online at GNUWorldOrder.info or at SlackerMedia.info. You can find me via email at Klaatu@member.fsf.org. That's member.fsf, as in Free Software Foundation, .org. And you can also find me on linuxquestions.org as notklaatu. Thanks for listening. I'll talk to you next time.